Chapter 33. Bane of the Ninth Bloodline. The Bane of the Ninth Bloodline took shape and substance from the angelic dead. Their flesh became its flesh, their armor its armor. All of that meat and ceramite was darkened and altered, but everything in the demon's corporeal form was harvested from the charnel field of butchered blood angels. It was a crop that grew in abundance here. Only the creature's weapons were pulled raw from the warp, appearing in its hands as the demon closed its claws into fists, a whip, an axe, the former parched and ragged, the latter catching the light of the poisoned sunrise. The craven god's shield of will had kept the demon and its kind away from the sanctum. But the half-mortal puppet was close to success in the webway. For that, the thing called Magnus should be tolerated in its exaltation. Perhaps not praised, and never trusted, but tolerated. The demon took its first step upon the gold-veined marble of the grand processional, leading up to the Delphic archway, and sounded its arrival to its lesser kindred. Once, this would have been a roar that cracked stone, a bellow ripe with pride. Now it was far more bestial, a laboured howl that oscillated the clutch of muscles in its throat. The demon had learned humility. It had been given no choice. Its lessers fled its presence, their own connection to reality yet frail with the craven god's aura so recently brought low. Far above, the Bane sensed one of the other exalted mortals, the Lord of the Red Sands, still flailing against the last vestiges of the false god's resistance. No matter. The creature needed no aid here from some half-mortal pretender. Beneath the demon's tread, marble soured to granite, the veins of gold transmuting to blood in the alchemy of unreality. Some of the mortals it passed cried out in worship. In past incarcerations, this would have amused the beast, and in further distant manifestations, it would have flattered it. The demon killed them now with careless gestures of destruction, in case their prayers were laced with mockery. Manifesting here had taken a supreme effort of will, and etheric vapour still steamed from the demon's skin. Behind it, in a spillage of warped afterbirth, came lesser shedders of blood, riding the brass-bodied rhinos born-forged in the war god's realm. The demon stretched its wings, feeling sinews crackle and crack. They felt unfamiliar and tight, which of course they were. This incarnation had never flown before. And the last time the creature was incarnated in the corporeal realm, it had lost a wing on the night it tasted deeply of shame. It sounded again, beast loud and beast dumb, a predator's warning whine. The first sweep of its axe reduced three statues to rubble, an act of needless spite that nevertheless contained a seed of joy. This was the sanctum of the craven god. This was where everything would end. And before that end came, this was where the Bane of the Ninth Bloodline would feed. There were yet angels upon the battlement, surviving in diminishing phalanxes against a host of demons, numerous enough to blacken the sky. Humans and angels beyond lined the royal ascension, ripe for bleeding. In every direction, false godlings with bodies of metal fought each other, the things mortals named Titans. Such a hunting ground. With a shudder at the feel of corporeality cold on its steaming skin, the demon turned towards the portcullis that held like clenched teeth in the maw of the Delphic arch. It could clear the battlement with a dozen beats of its warp-wet wings, but they were still weak and stunted, the membranes thin, the veins not yet pumped with what served the creature for blood. It needed to slaughter its way back to its former strength. The god of war wanted the Ninth Legion to bleed. He had dispatched his shamed champion to see it done, and at the end of the hunt lay redemption. Above all things, this demon desired redemption. The warlord, Oberosa, staggered as the chain fist slid back out of her guts. Mechanical debris rained from her disemboweled superstructure, crushing the war master's infantry swarming around her feet. She was dead, She knew she was dead, but her crew were still in control during her dying seconds. The two reavers that had carved her apart stalked back in case she lashed out with the power fist on her remaining arm, but her command crew couldn't muster enough locomotive force for a final blow. She vented her reactor and purged it of power in the same desperate exhalation, turning with brutal slowness and managing three steps towards the Delphic Arch before the motive light went out of her machine spirit. The Warlord Titan fell with almost human weakness, her knees buckling first, her waist failing second. Her murderers circled her, the reavers pouring fire into the cooling steel of her corpse. But her reactor was parched of power and refused to go Nova. When Oberosa toppled the rest of the way, it was just enough. The Warlord's corpse crushed the infantry at the portcullis, blocking the passageway with a mound of dead metal. There it lay, another Ignatum body outside the wall, loyal unto death and arguably beyond. The warhounds of Ordax took over from the vox-screaming reavers. Hindara was among them, a maniple of half a dozen ember wolves pounding their harpoons into the wreckage and doing their best to haul it out of the way. The last of the battlements' guns focused their fire on the titans and troops closest to the arch. On sections of the wall overrun by the Warmaster's horde, warriors in the colours of the traitors' legions set explosives on the autoloaders feeding the battlements' guns, or sabotaged them with blockages using the bodies of the dead. Karbanda watched all of this with burning eyes. The desperation of mortals, the absolute futility of their scrabbling dramas. He went over one of the warhounds with a crack of his wings, briefly irritated by the waspish buzz of the walker's suffering void shields. The Bane charged, his former blur of indifferent flame, heedless of what he incinerated on his charge to the portcullis. The demon tore through them, his axe not slave to mortal physics. The blade didn't cut metal, it rent reality. He tore a hole, ripped it wider, and crawled through. Infantry followed him, shrieking, praying, laughing. Pitiable, ignorable little things. They thought all of this was about them, what they wanted, what they deserved. Tearing through the first of the portcullises brought the Bane into the arch beneath the Delphic Keep, where the automated defences above rinsed him with firepower from 100 murder holes. In the forgotten mists of history, castle defences would have poured hot sand or boiling oil from similar openings. Here, heavy bolters and Vulkite cannons unloaded their anger, annihilating the infantry in the Bane's wake. The demon cared nothing for this. He was already carving through to the third portcullis. The demon possessed no vox and knew nothing of the legionaries' plans. Their pleas for the Bane to rip open the portcullises wide enough for tanks and titans to come through never reached his ears. Even if he'd heard their needs, in what mad existence would mortals expect Karbanda to do their work for them? Let them bleed outside the walls if they were too weak to get in themselves. The blood god cared not from whence the blood flowed, theirs or their enemies. It was all the same. Vulkite beams raked the Bane's ectoplasmic flesh from above, and the blood sweat on his skin ignited like promethium fuel. The demon never slowed, never wavered in his hunger for the blood that would run on the other side of the barriers. When he broke through, crawling and clawing his way between lengths of twisted metal, he gave another roar that could have come from the throat of one of the long-dead tyrant lizards that once ruled over the primeval surface of old Earth. He was inside. Ahead lay a marble avenue, infested with tens of thousands of warring mortals, and at the very end stood the gate. The demon felt the pull of his god's anger, his god's need, as he gazed into the open gate and saw the weaklings fleeing through it to cower in the sanctum of the craven god. But between here and there, thousands of angels fought amidst the throng, and their blood was promised to the god of war. They started coming for the demon now, some from the Royal Ascension, turning back to face the newest, largest threat, some from atop the wall, dropping down and attacking from behind. The creature sensed the efforts of smaller titans and tanks, doubling their efforts on the brutalized archway, and the zealous, righteous souls of blood angels descending upon him. This time there was emotion in his cry when he sounded his presence to the turgid sky. There was rage in the sound, and resolve, but above all, there was joy. Redemption was upon him. Let it begin. Orion had been dead for so long he could no longer recall what it felt like to be alive. He'd been cold for so long he could no longer remember what it meant to be warm. Even the dead could tire. Orion was proof of that. His weariness was a matter of cognition, not a physical thing, but that didn't stop it aching in what remained of his flesh. An activated dreadnought was supposed to go a matter of weeks at most without maintenance. Orion had been awake and fighting without maintenance for 4 months. He floated in the icy milk of his amniotic tank, the fluid desperately in need of purging and cleaning, feeling particulates and organic debris against his skin. He could feel clogs in several of his intravenous cables. The shell within which he was interred had been suffering input lag for weeks. Either it was struggling to obey his mental impulses, or he was too worn down for a clean cognitive link. Whichever the case, the result was the same. Corpses were not clean things. He was slowly being poisoned by the toxins of his own filth. None of his brethren saw this. They fought together on the ascension side of the portcullis, guarding the Delphic archway from the ground, and they saw the Contemptor dreadnought stand with 1 foot on a mound of the traitorous dead, laying waste to the Neverborn with its Kyr's assault cannons. They heard the artificial thunder of its battle cries, a simulated boom only loosely reminiscent of Orion's own voice. They saw and heard nothing of the revenant inside, curled fetal in its dirty fluid, its mouth moving wordlessly as its thoughts were translated to motion and vocalization. He was among his brothers, yet separated from them, here in the filthy cold of his false womb. The corpse twitched. Its lips moved.
"For the Angel and the Emperor," the dreadnought called.
It turned, panning with its cannons, the fire of muzzle flares lighting up its armored shell. In this cluster, just over 200 blood angels still fought, forming a shrinking circle against the Neverborn. The dreadnought's whirring guns cleaved through the demon's Icarus flesh, cutting them down, bursting them open, breaking them apart. Whatever had gone wrong within the sanctum, it was getting worse. The Neverborn pouring over the wall were growing, not only in strength but in size. It was impossible to follow even a fraction of what was taking place. Shadowy things sliced the air overhead. The ground shook, sometimes hard enough to throw the defenders from their feet. Creatures defying description, some defying even the attempt to look at them, manifested and vanished and reappeared and cavorted and fought and killed. And sometimes, but never often enough, they died. Every few seconds another blade crashed against his shell. The warriors at his side killed most of the demons bearing these blades, though more and more he had to kill them himself with a backhand from a cannon or a stamp of his immense foot. Feedback pulses reached the cadaver as a throb in the place where its hands used to be. The dreadnought stepped back, wading through the dead, moving to the center of the Blood Angel's circle. A clutch of thralls and cyborg servants still held out within the regiment's defensive ring. The corpse twitched. Its lips moved.
"Reload,"
the war machine ordered, as he brought himself to one knee with a protest of wearing down joints. They dragged ammo hoppers towards him and went to work. There was the moment of conflicting freedom and vulnerability as the empty canisters were unbound from his guns, then the reassuring weight of their replacements crunching into place. The seconds passed in excruciating slowness, with the noise of his brothers fighting and dying echoing in his damaged aural receptors. With his senses failing, all sound was ghostly and indistinct, through the amniotic fluid and the muffling iron of his shell. One of the thralls banged a fist against his armor plating. The corpse twitched. The dreadnought rose. Orion didn't feel immortal. Titan crews told tales of how it felt to embody the god machines they piloted, how they felt the immense metal superstructures as their own flesh and blood. Orion felt no such connection to his shell. He was a corpse in a cold coffin. The Kyr's cannons weren't his arms. The shell wasn't his body. What emerged from the Vox system in the shell was his emotion translated into words through a machine spirit. Accurate, but imperfect. His experience of the world was entirely untactile. He was the living dead core of a war machine that killed when he told it to kill. The corpse twitched. The lips moved.
"We are the wrath of angels," cried the dreadnought from its voxcaster. "We are death to the treacherous."
He strode forward, reinforcing the outer ring where the line was bending back, opening up with both cannons. They cycled live, warming up with twin metallic whines, then chattered with recoil as they liquefied the Neverborn. The line was breaking. The Neverborn cut into the defensive ring, the first of them making it to the groups of thralls and servitors in the middle. Orion turned, his cannons reducing the demons to etheric mints. He strode forward, heedless of their blades, his iron feet grinding through warp slush that blackened the red of his shell. The ground shook again, hard enough that the compensators in his joints momentarily jammed. The corpse thrashed in its amniotic murk, its mouth opening and closing, struggling to discern anything through its mental heads-up display. He could see, sense, the enemy everywhere, too many to fight, beginning to swarm his shell. Each shiver of the royal ascension seemed to breed more of the things.
"Brothers," he thought. "Brothers to me."
The words lodged somewhere between his mind and the voxcaster, so all that emerged was a furious snarl. They came for him, several of his kindred carving the beasts off his shell and granting him enough time to stabilize himself. Gratitude flooded him, the strongest emotion he'd felt in days. The corpse twitched. The lips moved.
"I am grateful," the dreadnought said for him.
But there was no respite. Even as the shell threw off the last of his attackers, he was turning to open up on the next foes. Inexorably, they were pushed inwards, the defensive ring shrinking with each lost life. They shrank against their reserve ammunition and weapon caches, as the vox crackled, a steady stream of reports from other clusters in the stand and die forces. Orion could see, sense, through the portcullis, where Ignatum's engines were clustered outside the wall, holding the line against the War Master's own god machines. His vision was a multi-layered heads-up display, blending picked lenses, echolocation, and Auspex scan pulses transmitted to his mind's eye, and it flared with impression cascades each time a Titan died in the wasteland. It flared brightest of all as something struck the portcullis from the other side. Something that had no right being there. Something carving its way through as its skin erupted with unnatural fire. Orion had fought on Cygnus Prime. He was almost a century dead by the time of that campaign, interred within this coffin and awakened only rarely between battles. But he'd been on the surface of Cygnus Prime when the Legion learned the first grievous truths about Horus's war. He knew what he was seeing when the axe tore through the portcullis, and he recognized the demon that burst through in its wake. The name ripped across the vox in amazement, in warning, in defiance, and in the voices of hundreds of warriors.
"Carbanda,"
the dreadnought shell voxcasted, following Orion's unspoken thought. The corpse twitched. The war machine raised its guns and started firing. He was the first blood angel to die to the demon's axe. It struck him with enough force to shatter his shell and send the dreadnought crashing across the ground of the Royal Ascension. When the shell came to a rest, bleeding oil and artificial womb fluid, cracks in the armor revealed the corpse within. Without the life support systems of its destroyed coffin, the mutilated corpse flailed helplessly, feeling the touch of the open air like acid on its skin. Orion took almost a minute to truly die, staring up at the sky with his own eyes for the first time in almost a century, choking on air he was no longer used to breathing. His death was technically a stillbirth, as he died while being born, thrown halfway out of his synthetic coffin womb. Such are the wonders of Imperial technology. The demon drank each life he ended. Souls swirled around his head, a halo visible to the others of his kind, a crown to inspire jealousy. With each fall of his axe, the demon reaped angelic life, feeling his corpus swell with returning strength. The cream of Blood Angel's heroism thrashed in his aura, their souls disintegrating to become part of him. As their identities crumbled, the Bane felt the memories filling out the hollows of his essence. He remembered wars against aliens he'd never fought. He remembered glories he'd never earned. He was flushed, bloated even, with the righteous anger of humanity's living weapons. Step by step, Carbander avenged himself on the legion that had seen him slain several corporeal years before. He craved their lives for his feeding frenzy. He could not take the gate without building his strength. He crushed angels between his fingers, squeezing them until pulped meat ran through the cracks of their ceramite. He ground the wounded ones beneath his hooves as they spent their last seconds of life hoping he could be killed with bolter fire. He killed with every step, not content to merely swallow souls, devouring angels whole or in pieces if they were moronically brave enough to come within reach. Several were wise enough to fall back, only for the demon's whip to lash them in coils and pull them within reach of eager curling claws. His wings thickened, grew stronger. His claws hardened, no longer feeling as though they might crack at the first rake of his talons. He licked blood from his palm and fingers, tasting the final desperation of the last warrior he'd killed. Armand was the mortal's name. 60 years of valiant service, not only to mankind's ignorant empire, but to the blood god that every warrior secretly served. How could they not know it? Every drop of blood shed fed the father of war. Here, of all places, all they had to do was look up and see the faces, the teeth, the smiles in the seething sky, horizon to horizon. Everything they did here fed the Pantheon. Even if they won, they would lose. Later there would be tales told of the battle for the Sanctum Imperialis, and in the way of such stories, they would be an uneasy mix of truth and lies. Zephon would hear many of these tales, in a time when memories of their father were all the Ninth Bloodline possessed. He would listen to the tales of how the great angel fought with his back to the Eternity Gate, and he would know which parts were truth and which were myth, fueled by idealism or manipulations driven by the speaker's agenda. Only rarely did he lend his voice to affirm or deny, no matter which way the stories went. Far more often, he would listen patiently and commit these newest tellings and mistellings to memory. Then, when the time came, he would retire to his stasis crypt aboard the warship Invictrix. A sleeper is not supposed to dream in stasis, but in this time yet to come, in the years after the war, Zephon always dreamed. In his visions, the tales he heard would mesh with his true memories, creating tales that danced along the border between fact and fiction. Upon rising, he would cast off these unwelcome dream echoes, but it became more difficult as the years wound on. The only time Zephon would disagree with a speaker was if they said Sanguinius had waited. He heard this often, between the tales of the great angel defying the entirety of the Warmaster's horde alone, which were glorious but equally impossible and fantastical, and these were the times he would say, in his gentle tones, that the speaker was wrong. He would lean forward with a purr of black armour, and he would say, "No. The great angel did not stand with his back to the gate and watch as the bane of the Ninth Bloodline tore its way along the royal ascension." In response, the speakers would inevitably become listeners, keen to know what happened through the eyes of one who fought at the great angel's side. Zephon would defer to let another speaker, if they knew the truth as he knew it, and only on the rarest occasions would he set the record straight himself. "What?" the listeners would ask, "really happened?" So Zephon would tell them.
"The duel was swift. That much of the old stories is true. It lasted scarcely 5 blows between man and demon. But the creature you speak of was not there for our father. He is not named the Bane of the Great Angel. He is the Bane of the Ninth Bloodline. He was there for us.
Zephon fell back, throwing aside his empty pistol and scavenging a bolt gun from the hands of a fallen brother. He risked a look back over his shoulder, seeing Arkan Land hobbling into the sanctum, part of a stream of wounded soldiers and militia. Turning back to the Ascension, he opened fire over the heads of his retreating brethren, cutting into the tide of world-eaters on their heels. Hundreds of blood angels manned the barricades outside the gate, funneling survivors through into the sanctum. The vox was a ceaseless spill of overlapping voices, those inside reporting on entire reaches of the sanctum's surface overrun, those outside repeating the same name Zephon had read in all the archival data of Cygnus Prime. He hadn't been there. He'd been on Terra, in his crippled exile. What little picked data there was hazy with etheric interference. Winged silhouettes, fragments of audio, replaying snarled threats. The sound of great wings beating. The kinds of fragments that later make legends. Nevertheless, he recognized the demon as he saw it massacring its way along the avenue. It hunted the warring blood angels, and they were the ones to die beneath its falling axe. Humans fled its presence, ignored by the creature, dragged down instead by the howling beast things in the demon's wake. The custodians demanded the Eternity Gate's closure, and Zephon had the rank to neither agree nor oppose them. He heard Diocletian's voice among those ordering the sealing of the gate, and for a moment he was back in the webway, marching with Land and Dio and the custodians, fighting against hordes of Neverborn in the fall of Magnus's folly.
No, the great angel said at his side.
Sanguinius slashed the air, flicking demonic blood from his blade. He didn't address Zephon alone. He spoke to every blood angel in earshot and every custodian within vox range.
Hold the gate open as long as you can.
I will deal with this.
With that promise, Sanguinius launched skyward. Ceramite crumpled between his teeth, broken up and ground down enough to swallow. The taste of Ninth Legion meat spiced each chunk of armored flesh. Every death was the murder of uncountable paths, a warrior that would not rise to primacy in the future, a legionary that would kill no more of the gods' children, an officer that would never become a hero. This served the Pantheon in their brief and jagged unity. But these fateful severances were of no concern to Kar Banda. The demon harvested the Blood Angels' souls and shed their blood as the currency of atonement. The courts of the four gods took much of their substance from ancient human aristocracies. After Cygnus Prime, Kar Banda had crawled, bleeding, before the Skull Throne, there to endure the war god's laughter. He could have suffered through the mockery, marking the names of his kindred that laughed loudest in their creator's shadow, and adding them to the butcher's bill once this time of shame had passed. Every sneer and smirk would motivate him. But Kar Banda had not been ready for the war god's disgust. The Lord of Blood had not derided him like the lesser creatures of the court, nor punished him in a rage, as had happened to the wingless one, the exile Skarbrand, for the moronic sin of taking up his axe against the blood god himself. Khorne, armoured in runic plate and as tall as the chain-wrapped sky, had regarded his beaten champion, who brought the stink of failure into this sacred realm in the warp's deepest reaches. No punishment. No mockery. Kar Banda prostrated his ruined form before the Skull Throne, feeling the eyes of his former underlings upon him like the itching of vermin. There, before courtiers, in the shapes of 1,000 beasts and monsters, the Blood God dismissed his failed Templar with a flick of armored knuckles. Reality melted around him, and when it took shape once more, he was far from the court of the Brass Lord. The rage that had sustained him and formed so much of his identity was cold and slow to rekindle. He hid from his former lessers in the farthest reaches of the Blood God's realm, at the edges where shadow and unshaped warp became one. In the unformed wastes, he survived on the pathetic souls of ignoble ends and deaths devoid of consequence. He could not remake himself without the war god's favor. He was without weapons, his armor ruptured, his wings too mutilated to soar. Hiding from his own kind made a sick kind of animal sense. Sometimes they hunted him. Packs of them tore through the unformed wastes, his former equals goading on packs of their weaker kindred. Carbanda would cower in the memory ruins of forgotten temple cities, cringing from pursuit and learning the taste of humility. And with that came a new weapon, one previously denied to a creature that relied wholly on the strength of his rage. Carbanda learned to be cunning. He hunted the hunters. At first he moved through the memories of dead civilizations and picked off the weakest of his kindred. Devouring his lessers would once have been as shameful as a human fighting a stray dog for a meatless bone. But he was so weakened by his destruction on Cygnus Prime that even a vulture's portion was enough to restore him by degrees. A timeless time passed, in a realm where time is just a story told by creatures that cannot understand it. Carbanda nurtured the dregs of his strength and gathered the weapons dropped by his prey. This slow rejuvenation became the entirety of his existence. He made the long journey alone back to his creator's court, always careful to move unseen at the edges and dark places of Khorne's war-torn realm. His lessers and former equals, many now his greaters, in truth, jeered and threatened as he stood before the throne where he had once served as champion. His armor that day was a patchwork of stolen plate from the other demons he'd killed, and though they were miserable trophies, he cast down the blades and skulls he'd taken from those that had hunted him in the unformed wastes. He came to the throne, not crawling in defeat, but with a hunter's humility burned into his heart. The demon did not expect another chance, nor plead for one. He demanded one.
I have swallowed failure and learned its bitterness. Now let me redeem myself, or destroy me where I stand, for I have eaten enough shame to last an eternity.
The blood god had listened and set him a task, as mortal kings once did for their champion knights. 500 souls.
500 souls from the bloodline that shamed you.
That was no test. He could achieve that in a day, in an hour, if his strength returned swiftly enough. Malicious hope flared in the demon's core.
500 souls, the war god continued, from the bloodline that shamed you, harvested in the presence of the Angel of Blood.
The demon dined on their bodies and drank their blood like a glutton gorging on wine, ingesting the stories of their lives, leeching the strength of their deaths. It wasn't long before even the blood angels fled, falling back towards the gate or crawling into their battle tanks in a bid to find some way to fight back. They were slow, far too slow. Carbanda was war given form. Those that ran, he leapt upon or pulled back with cracks of his whip. Those that remained died where they stood. He heard them calling for their gene sire, and what a sweet sound their controlled panic made. These transhuman pretenders to immortality, eloquently begging for the aid of their angelic prince. Carbanda cut them down mid-plea, feeling their pain spiced with desperation as their souls meshed with his essence. The demon did not count lives as a mortal would count. He simply knew. He felt the tally of souls in his essence, each one becoming part of his corpus as it was torn from the flesh and freed for the warp to claim. Swollen to his previous power, the creature never slowed, never ceased. When his prey retreated, he gave chase. He lashed them down. He cleaved the earth with his axe, pouring his wrath into the ground to swallow groups of earthbound angels. Within corporeal minutes after manifesting, the creature was close. He could feel the eyes of his creator above, and the zealous, jealous hate of his bloodletting lessers. The angel landed before him, wings spread in artistic intimidation, pale features composed in warlike serenity. That serenity was almost believable, but for the hate that burned in those beautiful eyes. Carbander was immune to the Primarch's masquerade of perfection. He knew the fear of failure that ran through his foe's bloodstream, and he'd breathed in the angel's hatred before. Their presences exerted a pull of gravity, the battle coalescing around them. The blood angels coming for the demon lord were cut apart and dragged down by red-skinned children of Khorne. The demons foolish enough to run at the angel were destroyed by the phalanx of Astartes forming around their Primarch. "Demon," Sanguinius said with almost disbelieving softness, "are you so eager to die a second time?" To the demon's way of seeing the world, in smears of life force and promises of running blood, the angel looked burdened by weariness. He could sense the exhaustion burning off the angel's sweating skin. Carbander smiled, his own unease dissipating. His tongue slopped from his parted jaws and polished the cracked obsidian of his teeth. Slaver hung in ropes from his maw.
"You look tired, little angel of the craven god."
It began on the ground. Angel and demon came together, blade on blade, beating their wings for balance in opposition. "I killed you once," the angel snarled into the demon's inhuman visage. Carbander's answer was to clench the muscles of his gullet and craw, bringing up a steaming flood from his replenished guts. Laughing, the demon vomited the lifeblood of Sanguinius's slain sons into their father's face. The angel endured the pain and the shame without retreat, which only delighted the demon more.
"I will kill you again,"
the ninth Primarch swore through the effort of matching the demon's strength. Blood hissed and steamed on his armor and face. It trickled into the lines of his lips. Carbander bared his teeth, fury melting back, replaced by a mocking grin. The creature had expected these words. Now they were spoken, he welcomed them.
"In your arrogance, you still believe this is about you and me."
The demon barked a laugh, bloody saliva spraying from his jaws to decorate the angel's already bloody features.
"That, O purest one, is your father's vanity within you."
The demon was ungifted at reading human expression, but something like pain flickered on the angel's face, and that too was beautiful. Carbander drew his gargoyle head back, brazenly readying for a headbutt. The angel launched backwards, just as the demon desired, and Carbander stole those precious seconds of freedom to turn and sweep his great axe through the warring blood angels and Neverborn nearby, butchering swathes of both. Strength flowed through him with a cramping sting, and the creature turned in time to catch the angel's blade against the flat of his axe. Again they came face to face.
"I am not here for you."
The demon's mouth wasn't made for human language, and his fangs were aligned for the aesthetics of cruelty, not set by evolution.
"You are nothing. A flicker in the fires of time. A pawn with pretty wings calling itself a king."
Sanguinius's eyes were tight, half closed with the strain. Words were almost beyond him, every vein and tendon thickly visible. Carbander's blood-coated throat was already hoarse with the effort of human speech, but more words bubbled up and forth through a knife-fanged smile.
"You taught me patience, angel of the craven god. You taught me my place. I am the beast that will feast on your sons in the centuries to come. I am the cancer that will eat away at your lineage until the last man with your blood in his veins is dust in Balfora's wind."
Fire from the burning avenue reflected along the length of the angel's blade.
"I will destroy you, demon, every time you crawl from the prison of hell."
Carbander, teeth clenched with effort, spoke with his breath reeking of Astarte's blood. Insidious sensuality flavored his tone.
"You won't be around to defend your children forever."
Sanguinius paled beneath the war grime darkening his features, and Carbander roared, hurling the angel back. Sanguinius twisted in the air, avoiding the swing of the axe, but not the lash of the whip. It barely struck, coiling around one wing, but it was more than enough for the demon's need. Carbander dragged on the leash, pulling the Primarch from the air and back down to the broken marble. Sanguinius struck with inhuman grace, already weaving to slice at the entangling lash. Carbander cared not. He abandoned the whip, leaping and beating his wings, making for the centre of the Royal Ascension, where the Blood Angels clustered at their thickest. World Eaters and the War Master's other half-mortals cried their blessings up at him, as if their benedictions mattered at all to a being such as he, in a moment such as this. He landed amidst dozens of red-clad Blood Angels, reaving them from life with swings of his axe, sounding his Carnosaur roar as he devoured their souls and stories. Names and faces and memories not his own saturated him, threatening his senses. Still the creature killed, using every precious second. A few more. The failed champion's thoughts were a storm of uneasy, unsettled psyches. A few more. Twice more the angel was upon him, cutting and hacking. Twice more the demon managed to break free, battering the Primarch aside or hurling him away. Carbander fled again, taking flight, and this time the angel was on him in the air. The two of them crashed to the earth scarcely 2 seconds after leaving it, the slender golden figure rolling atop the demonic giant, raising his sword, plunging it down. The demon pounded the angel aside with the flat of his axe, desperation sinking into his essence now. This was faster than their battles on Cygnus Prime, devoid of posturing and skill, reduced to the clumsy viciousness of a brawl. He rose, bellowing, roaring for opponents, launching himself at the closest Blood Angels and rending them limb from limb. Their bolters spat up at him, their swords cut into him, and they died making that display of futile wrath. The angel struck him again, this time with enough force to throw him from his hooved feet. The Primarch was a hunting hawk, all wings and cutting edges, thrashing against the demon as it fought to get free. Carbander shielded his face with his free arm a moment too late. He snarled at the crash of the silver blade laying open his face to the bone, stealing one of his eyes. It didn't hurt, as mortals feel pain, but shame and rage burned in their own ways, just as fiercely. Carbander reached blindly with one arm, raw fortune letting him close his fist around one of the angel's legs. He cracked the Primarch like a whip, smashing him into one of the statues lining the ascension, not turning to see how wounded the angel was, not caring beyond the fact he was free. He could slaughter a few more of the angel's miserable children and make for the open gate. The God of War would reward him, restore him to favour. He beat his wings, gaining the sky, hurling his axe at the incarnadine form of a legion fellblade. The weapon cut through to the tank's core, detonating it in a plume of fire that smoked with fresh souls.
Just a few more.
The demon weaved aside from the irrelevant slashing of lascannon beams and rockets going wide. Unarmed but for his claws, he dived towards the Blood Angels closest to the gate. His claws would be more than enough. Zephon was one of those hurled aside in a tide of crashing ceramite as Blood Angels were thrown from the demon's path. Its bleeding wings were a tattered banner, proclaiming its march to the Eternity Gate. Talons the length of spears raked through red armour and tore open the precious meat beneath. Every soul torn free quickened the creature, hastening its charge. It wanted the gate, and it wanted the blood of the gate's defenders. The beast refused to fight the angel in the air, where Sanguinius held every advantage of agility. They ran at it with swords that broke upon the beast's skin and fired weapons that vultured away chunks of its corpus without slowing the creature at all. It clawed and carved and clutched and twisted. Ceramite gave and blood ran. Never once in its killing fury did the creature's eyes leave the guardians of the gate. The deeds and doings of tanks and titans and primarchs were meaningless. This was its last chance. Zephon held his blade two-handed, ramming it through the creature's calf. It was like forcing a sword into bedrock, and the generator in the hilt backlashed, sparking out and failing in his grip. In the space of 2 seconds, Zephon drove the sword home, failed to wound the creature, and was smashed aside by the slap of one vast wing. He rolled across the Ascension's final plateau stair, close to the edge. One of his eye lenses was smashed. His retinal display screeched with warnings of suit rupture and wounded muscles, as if he couldn't feel it already. He pulled himself to his feet, reaching for his fallen blade on the marble nearby, ready to throw himself uselessly against the creature again with the rest of his brothers. Sanguinius was a bolt of gold and silver, harrying the demon from above. The creature tried to ignore the angel, then to batter the Primarch aside. Then, failing, enduring the wounds weaved by the angel's blade, the demon was forced to slow in its charge, venting its pain and frustration in another roar. It clawed for the Primarch, not to maul the angel, but to bring him to earth. On the third grasp, the demon managed it, dragging Sanguinius from the sky and throwing him to the cracked marble beneath its feet. Zephon had never seen two creatures of such immense dignity and power, reduced to such frenzied brawling. They rolled together across the Ascension's plateau of priceless off-world stone, raking at one another's eyes and driving their fists into armored bodies. Each time the angel pulled free, the demon dragged him back into the brawl. When the demon surged back up, the angel was upon it a half-breath later, a white-winged shrike circling the creature and raining silver blows. Carbander's roars became howls, then bestial detonations of anger and pain. The demon had lost an eye. Zephon saw the great angel pulp it in his fist and hurl the resulting sludge aside. When Zephon ran in with several of his brothers, Sanguinius ordered them away in a strained voice over the vox.
"The world eaters!" hissed the Primarch. "Hold them back!"
The demon and the angel clutched each other by the throat, the former to choke the life from the other, the latter using his grip only to smash the back of his foe's head against the marble ground. Sanguinius, dark with strangulation, with strings of spit hanging from his teeth, wrenched the demon's head up and down, again, 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 first cracking the marble with the anvil of Carbander's skull, then breaking it. The stone broke, while the beast's head refused to. Nevertheless, it was enough. The creature's claws went slack for long enough that the angel broke free. Zephon saw his sire launch into the sky. The demon was either unable to ignore this foe, or too wounded and blood-frenzied to let it go. With a spray of stinking blood from its wounded wings, Carbander gave chase. Later, it would regret this. Later, it would realize it poisoned its final chance at its fading victory, the moment it abandoned its hunt for the souls of the Ninth Bloodline, when it allowed rage and fear to shroud its vision. Later, it would be too late to matter. Zephon was free for long enough to witness the brawl's end. He saw Sanguinius descending as the demon rose. The Primarch had drawn both spear and sword, and the angel hurled the lance with a cry of effort. The spear took the demon in the chest, penetrating armour and corpus, sinking home as if it belonged there. A thunderous cheer rose from the warriors on the ground, Zephon's voice among them. The demon's next roar was wholly bestial, a cry of vented frustration. Wounded, in truth, it struggled to climb, feverish, almost fearful in its need to catch its tormentor. Sanguinius gave the wounded beast what it desired. Zephon watched his Primarch close the distance, white wings sleek to his back. The angel took the creature as it was gaining strength in its climb, rolling aside from the demon's reaching claws and striking from behind with the force of the Emperor's own wrath. He hit it between the wings, his sword hilting in the creature's spine, shattering its back and bursting from Carbander's breastplate. The blade's point hissed with the smoke of stolen souls leaking from the wound, and the demon hung in the air a moment more in defiance of mortal law. It gagged, and a sludge of undigested spirits sluiced from its open jaws. Carbander dropped, the creature crashing against the sanctum wall and leaving a smear of demonic blood as it fell. Its wings no longer beat, its limbs were dead. Sanguinius followed the body down in a dive, gripping the demon by the back of the neck and the hilt of his sword impaled in its spine. He could have let the creature fall. Zephon would always think that, in the days, the years, the decades that followed, when he wore black and fought for an imperium he no longer understood. Sanguinius could have let the demon fall, striking the earth before the Eternity Gate. But the angel screamed, the sound as invested with rage as any sound that ever left the demon's throat, and he hurled the dying monster out across the royal ascension. It crashed amidst the advancing horde and rolled bonelessly down the marble stairs, a monument to the failure of naked fury. Zephon's last sight of Carbanda was as packs of lesser demon kind swarmed over the body, doing their carrion work. There was no comfort in that, no vindication. It echoed too closely to the Ninth Legion's old rituals. He wanted to acknowledge no kinship between his kind and theirs. Sanguinius landed before the Eternity Gate, weakness forcing him to one knee. Platinum hair, streaked with blood, curtained over his features. His heart beat out of time in his chest, too hard, too fast, too weak, too slow. He felt every hour of the war, too much of it, thickening his blood, filling his head. They needed him to be everywhere, to do everything. He tried. He'd done all he could. Hour after hour, day after day, week after week. It was never enough. They always needed more. All he'd wanted was to give it to them. The horde saw him falter, and it surged for the gate. They heaved forward with one voice as one tide. The closest blood angels rallied to him, ringing him in ceramite, offering their flesh as a shield to purchase the time their sire needed to rise once more. He heard them fighting, dying, selling their lives to lengthen his. Sanguinius clawed for his dropped sword, rising, joining the fight on the ground as he stretched the quivering lock of muscle cramps from his blood-stained wings. Behind him, without his order, the Eternity Gate began to rumble closed. The doors drew towards him, folding closed on tracks that had never been tested. The Vox was alive with the calls of struggling custodians, demanding he fall back within the sanctum, pleading with him to aid in the purge of the final fortress. The Emperor needed him, they said. The gate had to be sealed. Inside the sanctum, they were being overrun. He heard Diocletian's voice above the others, the last tribune ordering Sanguinius inside as if the Primarch were a line soldier and not the Emperor's own son. Sanguinius stared at the battle raging along the royal ascension. Thousands of his sons still embattled on the marble stairs, thousands more still engaged on the Delphic battlement. Humans of the Imperial Army, Titans of Legio Ignatum, his own blood angels, tens of thousands of them would remain out here. So few had yet reached the sanctum, yet the ground quaked with the Eternity Gate's closing mechanisms, making the decision for him. World-eaters bayed and howled and died at his feet for the sin of thinking they could end him. Neverborn burst and disintegrated under his blade. The gate ground on, a twin doorway the size of a hab tower, tectonically scraping towards closure. The engines responsible for its sealing had never needed to function before. Sanguinius fell back, first only a single step, then a second, a fighting withdrawal that brought him into the shadows of the sealing gate. The blood angels at his side fell back with him, leaving only when he commanded them to run, to reinforce the others fighting the Neverborn within.
"It's over," he breathed.
This was the way the world ended, with the crash of a closing door. He stood in the deepening shadows, watching the foe in their thousands running for the gate. Too late. All of them too late. A Titan, a lone warhound, rattled along the royal ascension, its jagged gates screaming evidence of overworked stabilizers, and its gushing vents promising a reactor detonation without swift control. The Titan crushed warriors of both sides beneath its canine tread, heedless in its headlong run. It hunched lower, bearing down as it lurched its sprinting way up the parade stairs. Its armor plating was cast in the black and mottled crimson of the Legio Ordax. On its carapace was the name Hindara. That was the moment Sanguinius realized why it was running. The warhound stopped short of the gate, hammered its stabilizers down into its joints, and fired its Ursus claw. The harpoon struck the Eternity Gate with the tolling of a funeral bell. It hit true, drilling through the layered armor, impaling the Emperor's carved image.
When the chain slashed taut, it did so with the sound of Carbander's whip, and the warhound began to back away. The gate's left door buckled, closing slower than its counterpart on the right. The warhound dragged, straining at the end of its leash. Around its ankles, the charging horde cried in triumph. The angel rose on tattered wings. He would cut the chain.
There is time. There is still time.
Only to hear the thunderclap pound of more harpoons hammering home in quick succession. The jackals of Ordax came together in a pack, a full maniple, their spears lanced into the same door. They dragged back in ugly lupine harmony, each chain cracking taut. The gate slowed. Stopped. Five chains. He could break five chains. He lifted his pale eyes, seeing a flaming star fall from the warp-locked sky. A star with wings that bellowed his name in his brother's voice.